I'm sure many of you have heard the statements, you know you're getting older when. I have one to add to that. Just discussing it last night with somebody that when you're going down the road listening to the radio and you hear one of your favorite songs and you listen to it and at the end of it it says, that song was brought to you by your oldie station. That is just wrong. Well, some of you might remember this particular oldie. I admit I didn't know this song, but I did know the group. Long before reality TV, there was the Monkees. Remember that? Remember that show? And the it was a TV show about an imaginary band. Now, I admit I had it backwards. I thought they were a band and they made a show about it. They made the show before they became a band. In fact, one of the members, Mickey Dolenz, he said it was a TV show about an imaginary band. They wanted to be the Beatles, but they were never that successful. But they eventually became their own band, and they started recording albums themselves. Although Mickey Dolenz had described it, the Monkees becoming a real band is like the equivalent of Leonard Nimoy really becoming a Vulcan. If you know Star Trek, you'll understand the significance of that. And yet some of their songs really became hits. Last Train to Clarksville, I'm a Believer, Daydream Believer. These are all very popular songs made by this imaginary band. And in fact, at their peak in 1967, the Monkees outsold both the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. They got that popular out of a band that was really make-believe. Now, one of their songs that didn't make it big on the charts, but I think really captured the soul of that generation and even speaks to our generation today, went something like this. And no, I'm not going to sing it. When the world and I were young, just yesterday, life was such a simple game a child could play. It was easy then to tell right from wrong. Easy then to tell weak from strong, when a man should stand and fight or just go along. I remember when the answer seemed so clear, we had never lived with doubts or tasted fear. It was easy then to tell truth from lies, selling out from compromise, who to love and who to hate, the foolish and the wise. But today there is no day or night. Today there is no dark or light. Today there is no black or white, only shades of gray. Now I'm sure those words expressed the philosophy of a lot of people back then. And I think it expresses the philosophy of a lot of people today. Now there are rights and wrongs. But those lines are getting blurred, aren't they? Things aren't as black and white as they used to be. And between the black and the white, there's this vast, wild wasteland of gray. A lot of people even question whether there are any absolutes anymore when it comes to right and wrong. And besides, who's to say? This whole matter falls under the subject of ethics. And over these next several weeks, I would like to look at the subject under the heading Black, White, and Shades of Gray. And no, I've already had a few questions this morning. It has nothing to do with the book out, 50 Shades of Gray. Nothing to do with that at all. I want to deal with how do we determine things that are right and wrong, and particularly things that aren't specifically mentioned in Scripture. Because there are a lot of questions we face today. There's a lot of issues that are faced today in our personal lives and in our culture that you can't turn to a chapter and verse and say, thou shalt and thou shalt not. How do you determine? And I'd like to examine that over the next several weeks. Ethics answers the question asked in Ezekiel 33:10, how should we then live? It's about what we do. It's about decisions that we make and the activities in which we are either involved or not. In short, ethics is a system of determining right and wrong. Now, former President Lyndon Johnson was once quoted as saying, "Doing what's right isn't the problem, it's knowing what's right." Because before you can do what's right, you have to know what's right. How do we know right from wrong? Now, another word that's often used in this discussion is the word morality or morals. And many people use those interchangeably. Ethics, morality, all means the same thing. Not quite. Historically, there's a profound difference between the two. The word morals comes from a Latin word that means manners or customs, and it describes the behavior of certain people. Morals is what anthropologists study. They go into a culture and they observe, and they see how people interact, and they see how families interact, and how people conduct business, and how they relate to one another. And they record these things, and they see what is normal. What are the norms of this culture? What are their customs and their manners? And you find that these practices change from culture to culture. And you may find a society where stealing is not forbidden. It's not considered anything bad. So the morals or the morality for that culture with regard to stealing is that it's okay. It is simply a description of what is happening in that culture. The word ethics, on the other hand, comes from a Greek word meaning foundation or a root. And it has to do with the philosophical basis for right and wrong, how we determine what is right and what is wrong. It encompasses the reasons why certain behaviors are either acceptable or not. So to put it more simply, ethics is concerned with what ought to be done, whereas morals deals with what is in fact going on. Now, ethics is oughtness. Morals is isness, if those are really words. Now the Christian perspective holds that people are required to do what they ought to do, and what they ought to do is set by God. We read in Micah 6, verse 8, and you're going to hear this verse a lot during this series. God has showed you, O man, what is good. God has not left us in the dark. He has not left us to guess about himself, about ourselves, or about what he expects of us. But if we deny the possibility and the foundation of ethics and are left only with morals, if we only go by what everybody else does, then every person is in for himself. As the Russian author Dostoevsky said, if there is no God, everything is permitted. Now we hear today that there are no absolutes, except the absolute that there's absolutely no absolutes. That's what they say, the only thing you can say for sure is that there is nothing for sure. But if there are no ethical principles, we cannot possibly have a morality that is righteous except by accident. So how do we face the matter of ethics? We're once again faced with that question, who's to say? Now that question is answered in a variety of ways. And I'd like to briefly consider the broad panorama of ethics. These are ways in which people determine what is right and wrong. Now I'm saving the Christian view to the end. So these are other approaches that maybe you can recognize. Maybe you see this taking place in individuals or in the culture as a whole. And we're going to see some scriptural examples of each one. You're going to find out none of these are new. As Solomon wrote in Ecclesiastes, there isn't anything new under the sun. It's all been thought before and done before. And we're going to see all of these have actually taken place before. The first is called hedonism. This is the pursuit of pleasure as the ultimate good. Hedonism says, if it feels good, do it. I should be happy. That's the greatest goal in life, and so if it feels good, I'm going to do it. Solomon reflected this in Ecclesiastes 2:1. He says, I thought in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure to find out what is good. Notice that? He wanted to use pleasure, his own personal fulfillment and satisfaction, to determine what is good. Isn't that what ethics is all about? He was using pleasure as the standard. This ethical system is also echoed in Luke 12:19. I'll say to myself, you have plenty of things laid up for many years. Take life easy. Eat, drink, and be merry. I always thought Dairy Queen commercial made that up. They got that from Scripture. Eat, drink, and be merry. Live it up. Enjoy yourself. Now, you know what I hear a lot of from a lot of Christians? I hear them say things like this. Well, surely God wants me to be happy. You ask them, why are you engaged in this particular activity or this relationship? Or why are you behaving this way? Well, it makes me feel good. Doesn't God want me to be happy? We get this idea that God's greatest goal for us is that we be happy all the time. I would challenge you, show me that in the Bible. It's not God's ultimate goal. A second ethical system contrasts hedonism. It's called utilitarianism. And no, there won't be a test on this. This believes that the good of the many outweighs the good of the one. This tries to see the society as a whole, and everybody should contribute to the good of the many. But individual liberties, individual rights, individual opinions don't really matter. One contemporary example of this is seen in the policy of China, who, in order to reduce population, mandated that families could only have one child. Now, there are some exceptions to this, but for the most part, every family is limited to one child. Now, many families in that culture, they value having a male child to carry on the family name. And so what you have seen in the last 30 years is a huge number of abortions or babies that are left out to die, and the high percentage of them are girls. In fact, authorities claim that this policy has prevented more than 400 million births since 1979. For the good of the society, because we're getting overpopulated, these individual lives don't matter. They're disposable, because we have to look out for the good of the whole. But this idea, again, isn't new. During the trial of Jesus, the high priest Caiaphas said in John 11:50, you do not realize that it is better for you that one man die for the people than the whole nation should perish. We'll sacrifice this one life for the good of everybody else. Doesn't say much for that one life, does it? That's another way of looking at ethics. The good of the many outweighs the good of the one. Now, a third system of ethics is called naturalism. Sometimes it's called survival of the fittest, or might makes right. You've heard of that, haven't you? The golden rule, he who has the gold makes the rules. And it's basically the idea is if I can get away with it, then it's right. Now, I don't have time to read the whole story this morning, but in the Old Testament, the book of 1 Kings, chapter 21, it records a story of King Ahab and Queen Jezebel. You may have heard of those two characters. Ahab saw a vineyard that he wanted. The man who owned the vineyard was named Naboth. He goes to Naboth and says, hey, I really like your vineyard. I'll pay you top dollar for this vineyard. Naboth says, thank you for your offer, but this has been in my family for generations. I'm sorry, I can't part with it. Well, Ahab goes back to the palace and he's sulking and he's pouting. And Jezebel says, what's the matter with you?
Naboth won't sell me his vineyard.
And the queen smacks him upside the head and says, is that how a king acts? Come on. You've got the power. Take it. And they did. Falsely accused Naboth had he and his entire family exterminated so he could have his vineyard. Why? Because he could. Might made right. Another popular system is called consequentialism. It says the end justifies the means. It's okay to break a law if your ultimate goal is acceptable. Boy, you really get into a slippery slope there. An example of this is seen in 1 Samuel 15. King Saul is head over Israel. God speaks through Samuel the prophet. You go tell Saul, get the army, attack this particular area, and wipe it out. Everything that's living, dead. No exceptions. Samuel gives the message to Saul. Saul gets the army. He goes. He attacks. He's victorious. But he keeps the king of this enemy alive. He keeps the best of the livestock alive. And God comes to Samuel that night and says, I don't know why I even bother with this guy. He doesn't listen. You go tell him I've had it. He's done. So Samuel goes to give Saul the bad news of what God had just told him. And he walks up to the king, and the king says, Samuel, oh, great to see you. God bless you. I have followed the Lord's command. Now, Samuel knows better because God had talked to him the night before. And Samuel gives one of the greatest lines you'll find anywhere. You think God doesn't have a sense of humor? Read this story. No sooner does Saul say, I have carried out the Lord's command, and Samuel says, what then is this bleating of sheep in my ears? And the lowing of cattle, you know, over the hill. Wait a minute, everything's supposed to be dead. What's making noise if you've carried out the Lord's command? Saul's caught. So what does Saul say? The soldiers kept some of the livestock. You know, he always passes the buck. We're going to have a great sacrifice to God. He makes up an excuse. We broke God's law in order to have a big sacrifice to God. Samuel says, really? Don't you think God would rather you have just obeyed what he said? To obey is better than sacrifice. Just because you come up with this noble goal doesn't mean it justifies how you get there. And yet many people will tell you that the end justifies the means. It doesn't matter how I get there as long as I get to the goal. God says, no, I care about how you get there. But it's a very popular philosophy today. Another way of looking at right or wrong is called relativism. States that right and wrong varies from culture to culture, so there are no absolutes. You know, just because something was considered wrong at one place and one time, you can't transpose those rules over here. Everybody makes up their own rules. So, you know, you cannot take American values and morals and impose them on another land. That's wrong. They should make up their own minds. You see this in the conversation Jesus had with the woman at the well, recorded in John chapter 4. She asked him a question. She said, our fathers say we should worship on this mountain. You say we should only worship in Jerusalem. Who's right? The Samaritans have their rules. The Jews have their rules. Who's to say what's right? Jesus said, God does. God says what's right, and it applies to everybody across the board. Now, there's another system very close to this called subjectivism. It takes relativism and makes it personal. Not only does every culture get to make up their own rules, every person gets to make up his own rules. You say something's right or wrong, that's your opinion. I have mine. And everyone's entitled to their own opinion. I get so sick of hearing that phrase. It's one of those that if you had a dollar for every time you heard it, you'd be rich.
Everyone has a right to their own opinion.
Yeah, everybody has a right to be wrong. Just because you have an opinion doesn't make it right. But I would say of all of the ones we talk about today, this is probably the most popular today. You try to tell somebody that what they're doing is wrong, they're going to look at you and say, who are you to tell me? I'll decide that for myself. I'll decide what's right and wrong. You know where you really find this? Oh, I'm going to step on some here. Parents. Don't tell me how to raise a child. I'll figure that out on my own. Right? You really want to start a fight? Talk to a parent about their children. Woo! Especially if you don't have children. Oh, wow. That'll really start a war. Everybody has a right to their own opinion. The Bible puts it this way. The last verse of the book of Judges. In those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Free for all. No king. Nobody to tell us what to do, so we can do whatever we want. Remember back in school, if the teacher had to leave the classroom? Uh-oh. That was my cue to hide under the desk. Why? Because there's nobody to tell us what to do. Everybody could do what they want. And that's what society has done today. Anything goes. It's okay as long as you believe it. You can make up your own right and wrong. One final approach I want to mention is similar to this. Really popular 20, 30 years ago. Maybe you don't hear it as much today. But that's called situation ethics. And the idea says that right and wrong depends on the situation. You can't have any rules. You can't make one rule that applies to every situation. So you approach every situation, you say, what is the loving thing to do? They're big on love. They're based on the old Beatles hit, All You Need Is Love, right? Love everybody. You don't need laws. You don't need rules. Just love. Problem is, what do you mean by love? Love has a very different definition in the world than it does in the Bible. And you see a tragic story in the Old Testament book, 2 Samuel chapter 13. Which again, we don't have time to read it today. I'd encourage you, if you get a chance, to take a look at some of these stories. Give you the condensed version. This is the family of King David. And David had a multitude of wives, which always led to trouble. I've heard people say, you know, God says it's okay to have multiple wives. No, He doesn't. The Bible records that people did, but it was never a good idea. And it was never God's idea. David had all these wives, and of course all these wives had different children. And you come across one of David's sons named Amnon and one of his daughters named Tamar. They had different mothers, so they were half brother and sister. The chapter begins by saying that Amnon loved his half sister. In fact, he was so in love with her, he was ill. Aw, can't you relate to this, guys? You know, you're in junior high or high school, and that girl, she's so cute. You want to be with her so bad. And you ever think about talking to her and you get that feeling in the pit of your stomach? Maybe that's where that 60s song, how did that go? Yummy, 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 I've got love in my tummy. And I feel like loving you. Yeah, remember that song? I don't know, maybe it was something you ate, but you know, whatever. We're told that Amnon was so in love with his sister, he was ill. He was sick because he loved her so much. And he didn't know what to do. So one of his great friends comes up to say, I got a scheme for you. Act like you're sick. Tell her you want her to take care of you. When she comes into you, you can have your way. He says, wow, that's a great idea. I think I'll do it. And he does. Gets her trapped. Overpowers her, and the Bible uses the word he raped her. Why? Because he loved her. Oh, he was so in love. He had to have her. But then the Bible records that as soon as that place, Amnon hated Tamar even more than he loved her before. See, the love was gone. And now, this woman that he just had to have, he couldn't get rid of fast enough. And she's saying, okay, you've done this to me, I'm yours now. And he said, no way, get out. So that's what situation ethics does. It's what's right at the moment, but then what? And it can change on a whim. Love, the way that the world defines love, is a feeling, and that feeling is gone. When that feeling is there, I've got to have you. When that feeling is gone, I got to get rid of you. And you can see what a mess that makes. So you have all these different ways. This isn't even all of them, but these are the main ones. All these different ways of determining right and wrong. How do we know? Who's to say? Are there any absolutes? Is there anything such as black and white? Well, I'd like to conclude this morning with the big problem of ethics. I'd like to tell you I'm going to answer all the questions today. I'm not. We're going to be doing that in the weeks to come. But we have to start with a major problem. A major problem in this whole area of ethics, and it's where all of these systems fall apart. And why is it that there are so many systems and they're all doomed to failure? Why is it that with all of our intelligence and our technological advances, we're no closer to an ideal society than they were a generation or two ago? In fact, how many people today yearn for the good old days? It was better back then than it is now. Why is that? And I believe the answer to those questions, the big problem of ethics, goes all the way back to the beginning of the human race. This problem isn't new. It's been around practically since day one. Now, the key to understanding this, I think, is well known, but many, myself included, didn't see the connection at first. So give me a moment, a few minutes. Let me take you on the journey that I went on in understanding this. Those of you that have heard me preach for any time, you've probably heard me mention the name of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Dietrich Bonhoeffer was a German pastor and theologian during World War II. He was executed by the Nazis right before the end of World War II because he stood against Hitler and his regime. Bonhoeffer possessed a brilliant intellect. His writings can be really, really deep. I got his book, which I would recommend. It's called The Cost of Discipleship. It goes through the Sermon on the Mount. It took me 3 years to get through that book because I would have to read it and reread it and reread it, and then I'd finally get it. The guy could be very, very deep. Now, the college professor I had that introduced me to Bonhoeffer mentioned a book that was simply entitled, and this was to be Bonhoeffer's greatest work. It was the one he said he wanted to be remembered for. The problem was he didn't live long enough to finish it. He had only had bits and pieces of it done, and it was left to those of his students to put it together. Now they've done a pretty good job of it. And I remember I was very excited when I got that book. And I opened to the first page, you know, after all the introductions and prefaces and all that stuff. Here's the first words of his book. The knowledge of good and evil seems to be the aim of all ethical reflection. Yeah, that's pretty good. What's ethics about? It's the knowledge of good and evil. Got it. I'm thinking, hey, maybe this one won't be so difficult to understand. Then I read the next sentence. The first task of Christian ethics is to invalidate this knowledge. I'm like, what? What are you talking about? And I'm already thinking, this is going to take me 10 years to get through this book. But then I continue to read. Already in the possibility of the knowledge of good and evil, Christian ethics discerns a falling away from the origin. Man at his origin knows only one thing, God. He's speaking here of when Adam and Eve were created. They only knew God. Everything they knew came from God. only in this unity of his knowledge of God that he knows anything else. Other people, his surroundings, all his knowledge is based on his knowledge of God. He knows all things only in God, and he knows God in all things. The knowledge of good and evil shows that he is no longer at one with his origin. See, man as the image of God draws his life from his origin of God. But the man who has become like God draws his life from his own origin. Do you remember when the serpent came to Eve and he tempted her? Do you remember the line that he used? You will be like God. Right? That was the hook. That was the temptation. You will be like God. And she bought it. And she ate of the forbidden fruit and then gave Adam, and he did as well. Man now knows good and evil. This does not mean that he acquired new knowledge in addition to what he knew before, but the knowledge of good and evil signifies a complete reversal of man's knowledge, which hitherto had solely been of God himself. Knowing good and evil, he knows what only the origin, God himself, can and ought to know. To know good and evil is to know oneself as the origin of good and evil. In becoming like God, man has become a God against God. Man's life is now disunion with God, with men, with things, and with himself. What he's saying is this. When Adam and Eve ate of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, think of, maybe we can rephrase that. Instead of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, think of this as the tree of the determination of good and evil. Now man determines good and evil. Up until then, God did. You understand what I'm saying? Before Adam and Eve fell, God made the rules. And man accepted that. God said, I'll tell you what is good, and I'll tell you what is bad. But when Adam and Eve ate the fruit, they were saying, that's not good enough. We'll do it ourselves. We're going to tell what's right and wrong. We're going to decide for ourselves. Our opinion matters. We are now the source of ethics. We determine right and wrong. And I think that's a clue into understanding Genesis 3:22, after the fall, why God kicked Adam and Eve out of the garden. He says, now man has become like one of us, knowing good and evil. See, there's a connection there. And it's not just an experiential knowledge. Now man knows what it's like to sin, because God doesn't know what it's like to sin. Never sin. God determines what's right and what's wrong. What man did in eating the forbidden fruit was he took that from God and said, no, I'm not taking your word for it. I'm going to determine it myself. And that's why all of those ethical systems fail, because they're all based on man's opinion. We have rejected God's truth. And the only way we're going to get back to what's right and what's wrong, the only way we're going to be able to determine black and white in this vast wasteland of gray is to get back to the point where we accept what God says is right and wrong. We can't go to what one author calls statistical morality, where right and wrong is decided by majority rule. We can't just allow others to set our standards for us. Well, if they do it in Hollywood, it must be okay. If they do it in New York, it must be good. And we can't even allow ourselves, like that verse in Judges, everyone did what was right in his own eyes. That's chaos. That's a prescription for disaster. Substitute God for that word, king. In those days, there was no God. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Boy, that sounds like our society, doesn't it? Now, in the weeks to come, we're going to get more specific in these areas. We're going to talk about what God says, how we use God's word in determining these things, but we've got to start right here, where we say, God, I'm going to accept what you say. I'm going to submit to what you call black and white. And in the days, in the weeks to come, we're going to see more and more works out in our lives. But we have to start here. Because until we say, God, I'm going to listen to your way, he's not going to tell us. It's only as we are open to his truth that we will see his light. We're going to close this morning. Hymn number 352. Hymn number 352. We're going to sing the second verse. In times like these, you need the Bible. Why? Because this is God's revealed truth. And when it comes to these matters of right and wrong, folks, this is where we've got to start. So in this, as we bring this message to a close, let God's word be that anchor. Let it give us the stability in an ever-shifting landscape of what's right and wrong.